Hello, welcome to Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is a little bit late coming to you. I had a lot going on and it kind of killed me dead, so I didn't manage to do anything for like a week after doing everything for like a week. So I'm here now, which is great. This is episode 27, Story and Plot, which is coming to you because I just read a book and then I just started another book and the second book was terrible. And I don't ever really want to name terrible books because other people love them, but they have specific problems in my mind, in my analytical mind, that are sort of impossible to get past. They have really big problems. They have major structural problems. Generally, when I don't like a book, it's either, well, I mean, this is obvious, the writing bumps me out, or there's nothing to care about, or I hate these people. And this one, the one that bumped me, it's a DNF. Did not finish because I got to page 40. And up until then, I was like, okay, well, these are terrible people. I don't like any of these people. They don't like each other. Nobody likes anybody. And there's nothing to root for or wonder about or hope to find out. Like, there's nothing. There's no mystery. There's no plot. And that's when I realized there's no plot. It's a literary novel. We know I don't like literary novels often. It's quite commonly because of this exact reason, because you don't like the people. I don't know why that's so common in literary novels. Like, here's some really despicable people who nobody likes, who hate themselves, and who don't like anybody else. Like, do you live in that world? I really wonder what's behind that. I actually started developing a theory that publishing, literary publishing, is run by people who don't like other people or themselves, who then always pick novels about people who don't like other people or themselves. But I think I might be making it up. There just has to be something to it somewhere. Like, I mean, writing is already self-selective because it's done by people who can sit still long enough to write. Although I suppose you could dictate it to voice to text on your treadmill or something, or while you're out walking your dog. But I'm not sure you can really do it that way in the sense that you have to focus. You really do. You have to be able to sit still and focus, which sounds hilarious coming from me, but I'm either ping-ponging around the house like a pinball or sitting still for 18 hours writing a book. Like, I don't really have a lot of middle ground. Or, well, I guess I do have a third gear, which is do all the things! Like, do this and do this. Like, finish this and make this happen and make this happen and make this happen in a focused kind of way. Like, yesterday I did that. I did all of these focused jobs and I got them all done. And then I woke up today like, oh no, what happened? Because it takes it out of me. And then I'm left with no bones. But I really do wonder whether writing self-selects in that way. Like, if it self-selects for people who, rather than going to the party, would prefer to stay home and write a book or read a book or both. Not simultaneously, can't do that. So it may be that, like, there's just a misanthropic kind of stay home and write books element to these people who are writing these books. But the thing is, the good books are also written by people who write books. And they're written by people who love other people and find people fascinating and interesting and worthwhile and would not actually, you know, eradicate them off the planet like a lot of these literary novels seem to want to do. Like, they hate everybody. They hate everybody. And again, I think they hate themselves. And you guys know that's not normal, right? Like, you're not supposed to hate yourself. You can get help. You don't have to keep replicating it in literary fiction. So anyway, I ran into that with this novel I tried to read this morning over breakfast. Yes, I read kind of fast, I guess. 40 pages is a lot for breakfast. But also, I was like, wait, what? Wait, what is the story here? We do not have a story. We didn't have a story. And it suffered, this novel also suffered from the fact that I read The Seminarian yesterday by Hart Hansen, who invented Bones. Well, he didn't invent. He adapted it. It was a novel series before that. But he made the series Bones what it is, and he's amazing and awesome, and you should read The Seminarian. It's not the kind of book I usually read. It's kind of a dad book, you know? Like, it's by dads for dads, which is a whole genre of fiction, which is fascinating. And somebody on Tumblr, who I follow, whose name, of course, I've forgotten, although I did send her a poster one time, she suggested that the reason people read dad books, people who don't involve themselves in relationship things, read dad books is because they're not generally about, you know, some big relationship, which I thought was very interesting. Is that true? I think that's very cool. I think she's right about that. So that's interesting. I don't know. I have to think about that. Anyway, it's kind of a dad book. It's a fantastic book. It has a really good story, and it has a really good plot, and it has a really good main character. And what else do we need besides other really good characters? So this is why this literary novel this morning suffered so much, because I had just read this excellent, I guess it's genre, because it's a mystery. It's more like detective fiction, though. Like, it's detective fiction. And so there's a detective who is hired, sort of, by a friend, bodyguard slash stunt person, to find out what happened to this girl she likes. Okay, where'd she go? We don't know. So that's the inciting thing, right? It's already 1 million times more story and plot than the one I tried this morning. Like, we actually know what these people are trying to do. We actually know what the goal is. And maybe I'm just a genre reader, but like, I think you ought to know that. I think you ought to have a sense of what the story's going to be about and what you want to find out. And in the course of this novel, this was so good and it was so complex, it almost made me want to just like crawl under the couch, because I don't do things like this and I wish I did. It was so complex. Like, things would happen and I'd be like, wait, what? That's out of the blue. No, it's not out of the blue. It turns out that thing was really, really important and driving all these other things. And so you find out what's actually going on, and, you know, the detective tries to sort it out and, you know, turns over a rock and other things start happening. And it's just so good, so complicated. And the whole time I was reading it, I wanted to know that initial thing, what happened to this person. I also wanted to know, what's up with this? What about that? What's going to happen with this? Are you going to pull it together and be good and do the thing? Which everyone in this person's life was yelling at him about. It's important to have a plot. I shouldn't have to say that. Imagine a short story with no plot. You would never do that. Something has to happen, and then other things have to happen that are important, that matter. Like, how do we not know this? Why doesn't literary fiction care? I'm really curious about that. And it's not because they're doing other stuff. This book was not doing anything. It was just some miserable people being miserable to each other and not knowing how to exist on planet Earth, which I don't get. Like, I really don't get the point of that. I really don't. Is it so people who also feel like that can read it and go, ah, yes, truth? Like, maybe, but you got a mirror? Maybe just use that. I don't know. I'm not sure what they're after. Sometimes literary fiction makes me feel like I'm from another planet, because I really don't know what they're trying to do or why they're doing it. Like, it seems so miserable to me. Like, just go out in the yard and dig a hole and kick rocks. And like, what's the point of what you're doing? I don't understand it. And yes, the writing is gorgeous, but like, you might as well be writing on the wall somewhere. Like, it's not accomplishing anything. I don't get it. So anyway, plot. Okay, what's the difference between story and plot? And this is a screenwriting thing, so we're going back to that. Again, that's most of the writing teaching I have endured. I did do an MFA, but we didn't learn anything in it, except for when, you know, certain writers would make us analyze things. Then I did the analyzing, and certain other writers would make us write things, and then I learned from writing the things. But we didn't learn things, you know? There weren't classes where you learned things. There were nightmare workshops, and there were like craft talks you could go to and go, oh, interesting, so that's how you do that. But we didn't have classes where we learned things. I don't recommend a program like that if you are sort of analytical like me. Like, I need to, like, tell me how to do stuff. So anyway, these people did back in the day. They said, here's story, here's plot. So plot is the events that lead to the conclusion. Okay. And story is what that's actually about. So you might have Luke Skywalker, the events, you could list the events of Star Wars, the important plot points, you know, kid helps his uncle buy some robots and they end up leading to blah, da, 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 everything that leads to the next thing. But that's not the story of Star Wars. The story of Star Wars is Luke growing up and coming into his own and finding out that he has these powers and going out and meeting other people who, being in a bigger world, right? It's hero's journey. Hero's journey, see, that's a good example because, thank you. How nice of you to compliment me, self. That's, I just picked it at random, but it's an example that works because hero's journey is in a lot of different texts. That's the story. but the plots are all different, right? So the plot is the events and the story is what it's about. In a big, this is where my students would recognize, like, you make that arcing gesture overhead. Like, this is what it's about. So, like, I might write a story that's about coming into your own and figuring things out and learning that you have what it takes and solving your own problems, while the plot might be about this or that or the other thing. I tend to write probably similar stories, but the plots are all very different. See? So now you've got that. Plot and story. But plot, so I didn't see either one in this, which is why it was such a problem for me. And again, I will sit through anything for good characters. I am watching season 6 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is not good. It's really not good. And I don't know what happened that was different, and I would love to hear the story behind it. So you've got a lot of really random episodes. Like, they made these weird, like, punk grunge people who are... Just start with me on the first episode, okay? You've got Fitz off in... working in some tanker thing where he speaks another language to blend in with all these other people who speak another language. And then all these aliens come to Earth who all speak English perfectly. And right then I was like, wait, so do aliens all, like, you can just throw at me, okay, everybody just speaks English, it's fine. But then you can't also have everybody doesn't speak English at the same time? Like, do you see what I mean? Like, it's like they weren't, I don't know, it was on some weird pilot system, like somebody else was driving the bus. It's very strange. It's just really odd when a series that you're used to for 5 seasons goes really different all of a sudden. And it's just like, what happened? Is somebody else in charge? I don't know. I don't know anything about the background of this. But it was fascinating. And of course, I love the characters, so I'm still watching it. But and the episodes are so weird. Like, the storylines are so weird. And the what's happening? And the plots are bizarre sometimes. And, like, more comic booky than usual. I don't understand. I'm not sure how to explain it. It's just really, really odd. It's almost like fan fiction. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you read fan, which I don't. I come across it sometimes because people post it on Tumblr. And I'm like, ugh. Because the tone and the style and everything are ersatz. Like, you can see their imitation and they ring really weirdly false. But, like, I support it 100%. But it comes across... like, it gives me Uncanny Valley. Uncanny Valley's not great. And that's kind of what I'm dealing with in season 6. Season 7 is the same, I remember. Like, it's just very, very weird. So, and of course, there's a fake Coulson, which makes it even weirder because he's not him. And he's like, why do people keep saying that word to me? And then they come up with this hand-wavy explanation near the end of the season. We're like, it's because... okay, we'll just... it's a show with this guy on it, but they killed off the character, and that's why we have him, and we know this, but we have to have a hand-wavy explanation inside the show. Anyway, so the plots are weird, and the stories are more cheesy than usual. Like, they end in, like, you know, neat little moral packages and stuff like that, and like... or sometimes they are absolutely meaningless. Like, let's all go to the casino planet, which already... I'm like, stop it. And then everybody who we care about ends up in the same casino on this whole casino planet, like in the same room, small room. Oh, I mean, I know why. I know why. It's because those are our people and we care about them. But, like, that's just there. There's no explanation for how out of an entire universe our people walked into the same room at the same time. Really? So there's things like that where, like, plotting just got thrown out the window. We just need them to be together, so we're going to make them together. Okay, I guess. Let's do that. There's also a scene that I remember making me so mad where there's this tiny, skinny, like, you know, like, model skinny woman in a jumpsuit. She's been in this jumpsuit the whole season long. And then at one point she takes it off to reveal these gigantic jeweled robes underneath. That couldn't possibly be there. Like, I have vigorous suspension of disbelief, but there are times when I'm just like, wait, no, Just no, stop it. Oh, man, this show. I'm just reupholstering furniture and I like it and it's comforting, but like season 6, it's like, wow. Okay, Casino Planet. Sure. All right, so plot. Plot. Genre tends to be plot heavy, which is fine. I like plot. You like plot. We like things to have a plot. We like to know that the thing that's happening causes the next thing, brings us to the conclusion. Each one of those plot points needs to be important. So I was reading this somewhere, that there are elements of plot that don't lead to the conclusion that you might not even include if you're summarizing it. What happens? What happens is, this happens. This person makes a choice. And that's why I'm always yelling, character, conflict, choice, consequences. You can buy a mug with that on it from my store if you want. So plot has to depend on character choice, obviously. Otherwise, you have these people bobbing along like an acorn in a stream. Do acorns float? I'm not sure they do. I think they do. I don't know. A leaf. It's bobbing along like a leaf on the water, and it is floating down the stream, and it has no volition, and it makes no choices. It just goes wherever the water takes it. That sucks. That is not a plot. That is just physics or something. That's just happenstance. Nobody needs that. Nobody needs that in fiction. I hate it in fiction. I wrote whole novels where that happened, where the character was just like, I don't know, stuff happens and I deal with it. Like, yes, I'm sure that replicates how life feels sometimes, but that's also inaccurate about life because we are making choices and we are causing consequences. And yes, unexpected things happen, but your choices determine the story, not the unexpected things. You decide what happens. The same events could happen to multiple people and they would all make different choices and they would all have different outcomes. Right? Yeah. So character, conflict, choice, consequences. Yes, it's a very good slogan. And I hope the religious right or somebody picks it up and buys a million mugs. Plot is important because randomness is not interesting. Randomness is not interesting. And also, if I can see the puppet master holding the strings, I get mad. That's why I get mad when, you know, they happen to walk into the same room at the same time on this planet, even though there's no earthly reason for either of them to know the other one was there or was going to be there. There's no way to know. It's just random. And that is so annoying. That is not a plot. Randomness is not a plot. Oh, it makes me mad. So story, I suppose, can you have a story without a plot? Literary fiction thinks so. I don't. I mean, I don't think you can even grow and change as a person without making some choices. Is that true? I don't know. Real life is not my area of expertise. What a weird thing to say. I'm going to think about that later. Not now. Story and plot. You can take the same plot and give it to 100 people and end up with 100 different stories. And I think that is very interesting. You can take the same plot and give it to 100 people and end up with 100 different stories. This is true about people also, because the way somebody reacts to a thing that happens or a choice that they've made, like, I don't know, what's a choice? Drunk driving or something like that. Something where you're like, you know, that's dumb and you shouldn't do it. And then, oops, you did it. And then something's going to happen because of it. What do they do when that happens? How do they react when that happens? When they've made a terrible choice and suddenly they're facing the consequences of it, what does that do to them as a person? And how do their choices affect that? And that's the story part. That's the story part. So if you have 10 people who all leave a party together, oh, now I want to write this. They've all been drinking a whole lot. They all go out and get in their separate cars. 10 is too many. Give me 5 or 6. And they all drive away. And different consequences happen because of those choices. How those people react to those consequences is the story. Like, one might decide, I made a horrible mistake. I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to straighten up and fly right, whatever. They join the military. They go to a seminary. I keep thinking about seminary because of reading The Seminarian. They make choices to change their life. Or someone else is like, well, I'm cursed. It doesn't matter what I do. Everything is bad. And it's very easy to fall into this kind of thinking, isn't it? I'm doomed no matter what I do. So I'm not going to even try anymore. I'm just going to go rob a bank or something. Like, it's very easy to take different stories out of the same series of events. And that is what's so cool about plot and story. So you can also have, what are some other consequences or stories that could come from that? Like, they meet somebody because of the conflict that happens, drinking and driving, or terrible, terrible choices. So in a writing sense, I don't know where other people start. I tend to start with the story. I start with the story of, here's a person who's in this bad situation and needs to become this other version of themselves to solve it. And I don't know how they're going to do it. I never know how they're going to do it. Like, The Nerve. I wrote this novel, The Nerve, that I have to, read, rewrite, and publish in the next week, 2 weeks, very soon. I want it out by the end of the year. I wrote it years ago. It needs to get out there. Out, out. The tricky thing about The Nerve is, and the wonderful thing about The Nerve is, it's a very, very straightforward story about someone who is in a pickle and doesn't know how to get out of it, and then makes a mistake, which I love, and then figures out how to turn that mistake to the good, and then solves all the original problems through the mistake, ultimately. Not quickly, but ultimately solves all of her problems, which is great, and I love that. Also, there's a really great mom in it who is so controlling, but not awful, which is, isn't that cool? I think that's good. I'm growing backwards because I wrote it before Thrush Cross. So it's a plot. Let me just say, it's a plot that is very clear and straightforward and involves music, and it's so good. That book is so dang good. This is why I've been holding on to it, but I think it's time to let go and just send it out there because I'm tired of holding on to it. Also, all these people, especially older people at the book fair. By the way, the book fair, amazing. So much fun. It was one of the reasons I was flattened for a week, but it was really fun. Oh, it was so good. I met so many people. I talked to so many different people. Some of the older people looked at the trilogy and were like, well, I don't like trilogies. It's too much of a commitment. And I was like, okay. There's also this standalone novel called Landslide, which was off to the side that nobody even looked at, which is funny. I wonder why, because they are all like, well, I don't like trilogies. Well, read a single standalone. I don't know. Who can say why people do what they do? The one thing the book fair really told me is that I am writing for my audience, which is probably people like 20 to 30. I don't know, something like that. 20 to 25, 26, something like that. And those were the people who bought the books, which I think is excellent. That's the audience for your books will find your books, is what that says to me. And the people who are not the audience for your books will look at them and go, oh, interesting, and move on, which is also fine. It's not for them. It's not for them. And it's okay if they know that. It's not only okay, it's good. Hi, puppy. Some people bought it for their grandchildren, which I thought was adorable. Yeah. So anyway, that was really fun. I met a bunch of other writers. I met some introverts. I went to this party. It was a nightmare. I hate parties. And sat down because I was like, I can't. I'm not. No, I'm sitting down. I sat at a table and various introverts came over and said, also an introvert? And I was like, yeah. And so I met the introverts and that was really fun. And it was just all good from beginning to end. It was exhausting and really great, and I don't even know what to say about that, except there's a lot of books left over, so if you want books, they're for sale on my site now for the same price they were at the book fair, which is not much money at all, and you should get some, and I'll mail them to you myself. You can skip Amazon, although Amazon did print them, ultimately. Oh, I looked up prices, and Priority Mail, so where I can use their envelopes, is $12, so that's what I put for shipping. If you live in the area, I'll bring them over and put them in your mailbox. No worries, for free. So that's easier. What else? Got a lot of books. Dang, there's a lot of books. Anyway, the thing I kept saying to people over and over, because they'd say, well, what are they about? And I'd be like, well, they're about 18-year-olds making terrible mistakes and then figuring out how to solve them. Which is generally true. It's not quite true of The Nerve. She doesn't really make a mistake, except for going to college because her mom wants her to, when she does not want to. which happens a lot. And I've met so many of these students. They're like, yeah, I'm going into terrible debt personally because my parents are making me be here. And I always say, like, you got to wait. You got to go do something else for a while. Don't spend this money unless you know what you're doing it for and you want to do it, because you are the one who has to pay it back, and that's not cool. Like, if they want to pay, that's one thing, but even then you're wasting a huge amount of money, and you should spend it on something you want, not something you don't want. What a waste. So I'm always encouraging people to drop out if they're at all interested in dropping out. I really don't think you should be in college unless you want to be. It's a waste of their time. It's a waste of my time. Notice I'm considering myself part of this equation, but it is a waste of your professor's time, and we only have so much, so just don't if you don't want to be there, and definitely don't go just to play sports. Like, what a waste. Somebody else could be there. Like, there are people who want to play sports and get an education, so the ones who don't want to get an education should not be doing it. Go do something else, seriously. So anyway, this girl goes to college and doesn't want to. Oh, it's awful. But she goes because her cello teacher is a professor there, and so she has a connection, and so she goes, and it works out. I mean, obviously, things work out in the end, because it's a book I wrote, but sometimes you find yourself in a situation that you don't want to be in. What do you do then? How do you change it? Especially if you feel very controlled by someone else. That's hard. That's really hard. And I'm noticing a tendency that I don't like. And I noticed it in the Becca book, 40 Days and 40 Nights, of giving people ways to earn a ton of money so that they can make good choices. And I don't care for that, because we can't all do that. We don't have that option. That's not something where you can just be like, well, I'm going to have a viral and make it. Like, no, mostly you just got to sit there and work and, I don't know, grade a lot of papers and stuff. And you're not going to have a lot of money from it. You're just going to get by. Like, I don't know if that's a thing. And it's feeling a little crutchy. And so I might have to take it away from Becca, because it's not cool. Like, she can be well known, sure, but not well off. That's okay. She's also incredibly frugal. So I like that about her. And I like it better if she's incredibly frugal, because she has to be, not because she wants to be. That's much better. It's much better. Like, when someone's stingy and rich, that's like, okay, why? What's wrong with you that you're wearing a t-shirt that you found in the lost and found when you could buy the town? Like, is that, what's going on there? Although that's a very interesting kind of question. It's almost time to watch Muppet Christmas Carol again, speaking of which. But Becca doesn't need to have, yeah, I don't know. She's not that kind of, like, I had her being sort of an online, like a TikTok sensation or whatever, and like advertising money, and like, she's just not like that, and it's yucky, and I don't like it. Anyway, that happens in The Nerve, and it happened in Thrush Cross. But the whole point of those was, in The Nerve, it's a flash. It's an artificially created viral thing that makes her a bunch of money and allows her to get out of a bad situation. And she kind of hires her roommate to make it happen, and her roommate makes it happen. She's a supremely powerful hacker type person with, like, she's just got her finger on the pulse and she knows what to do. And so she earns money doing it, which is fine. It's like hiring a PR person. And Thrush Cross, it's obviously artificial. Like, she's not the greatest painter anybody's ever seen. She just got popular because someone sort of hyped it up and made it a thing. And then the whole third book of the Thrush Cross series is this girl trying to figure out what to do now. Like, she's like, well, what if I can't actually be that? And she's not that anymore. And she's not pulling down big prices. She's just herself. And that's much better, but it's also terrifying. What do you do when you're not that thing? What do you do when you're, you know, a one-hit wonder and you're just you? That's got to be really hard. And so that's something to work out. So it's not just like this plot element that happens and solves the world. No, it kind of has consequences. And then you have to live with that. So, like, in The Nerve, our girl is now like a low-key, you know, recording artist. And that's totally fine.
which is what she wants, because the whole thing is she's a huge introvert. She does not want to be out there, fame and fortune. She only wants the fortune, not the fame. And she only wants the fortune to get out of a bad situation. Anyway, I'm catching myself in crutchiness and I don't like it. I don't like it. So The Nerve is coming soon to a theater near you. It's really my favorite novel of all the ones I've written. And I say that as someone with a poster of Finn in the room from The Icarus Triptych. My dog was actually just standing on the chair, gazing up at Finn in such a way when I was like, are you worshiping Finn? What are you doing? Like, she was, you know, paws up on the back of the chair, nose up to Finn's face, and just like gazing at him. And I tried to get a photo and I could not, but it was wonderful. And I don't know what that was about. That poster's been there since before she was born. So what? That was weird. That was really weird. She's a good girl. Anyway, The Nerve is super good and it's coming out soon. I have to find the cover artist for the cover I've been using all these years and see if she's got a reasonable price. And if not, more cover art. And I don't know how to do that because, boy, she's not on a road anywhere. She stays in town. She's not going anywhere. What do I do? Abstract? I don't know. The first person I met at this party, I handed over one of my little quarter sheet color printed flyers of my books, and the guy was like, ooh, really nice graphic art design. Like, thank you. I was very proud. It made me feel really good. Oh, it was not remotely his area of reading, but that was, isn't that wonderful? I love that. Because I do work really hard on it, and those were some of the early ones, and I had to show him the one of the worst, which has those black boxes, which I just learned how to do, like, literally a month ago in paint. So, I mean, I had Photoshop years and years ago on my old computer, but I don't have that computer, and I don't have Photoshop anymore, so And I don't have the expertise, so I use paint. And I use images that are either public domain or no, are copyright free, or I took the photos myself, or, you know, like this one I used for The Nerve. It was back when I was just trying to cheer myself on. I made cover art for some books to put up on the wall and say, see, you wrote some books, because I kept forgetting entire books that I had written for real. And so I wrote up each title on a 3x5 card and stuck it to the big corkboard in my writing room so that I could look at it and go, oh yeah, I wrote some books. I wrote a lot of books. And then I wrote all of the partial ones up there, which I should probably just take down. But it's good for me to remember the partial ones because sometimes I go back and rewrite them and turn them into whole new things. But some of them I don't. And I don't know, I just need a different way to do that, like a list or something, because it takes up the whole corkboard and now I can't use it. But there is a list of finished novels down the left with the word count. And that is very encouraging to me. But also the cover art is very encouraging to me. I cannot recommend this enough. It is so nice to see the covers of the books and just to imagine them as finished books. And then try to get the document itself, the manuscript, up to speed so that it too can be that book. Like, that's really good for you psychologically, and it was a really good motivator, and it also helps if you have zero memory and you don't remember entire books you've written. Oh dear, I don't think I can go back and read the early books. There's like four something, I don't know, there's a bunch of them that are just like, okay. Like the amount of excavation, it's like doing a renovation where you have to demolish the whole thing. I don't know that I want to do that, although I did just do it to Summerlands. Oh, Summerlands. I got to make color copies of Summerlands, and I don't know what 40 Days and 40 Nights might be, except it might... Okay, I guess I do. I have an idea anyway. It could be a photo that... Who did I give a camera to? Did I give the camera to Dennis when I was playing a rugby game? I don't know. I could do some kind of manipulation with that those images. Somebody took... Maybe it was Erica. Took a million images from rugby games, and I'm so glad that they have them, that they did that, and that I have them, because Otherwise, that's just in my memory. Becca, I'm making her play rugby because she's scared. Doing scary things really good for you when you're scared. Not the thing you're scared of, but something else, so that you can overcome the fear separately from the thing you're afraid of. See what I mean? So, like, if you're scared of public speaking, you go climb a mountain or whatever. Something different, so that you understand that the thing you need to overcome it is within you, and it's not out there in the thing that you're trying to overcome. It's in you, right? It's a useful strategy. Anyway, she gets to do that. So, yeah, lots of movies in that book that I have to work on. I have to develop all her movies. I am all over the place. I understand. I'm trying to do 10 million things at once. I'm trying to rewrite Summerlands. I'm trying to get the nerve out. I did get the worst out. I made it $6.66. Oh no, I'm laughing at my own joke. I just thought it was really funny. I don't know. It's not. It's funny to me. I don't think anyone will ever buy that book. But I don't care, because that's just hilarious. And I have the proof of it, and I have to read it and check it and edit it and everything. And there's no title on the spine because it's too skinny or something. I don't know. How can it be? There's no title. I have to figure it out. It doesn't matter because, again, no one will ever buy it. But it's out, and that's what matters. Oh, books. So probably I need to quit reupholstering furniture, which I did yesterday to the point where, I don't know, it feels like I burned my finger. Although it's also possible I burned my finger. My index finger feels burned. Yeah, like super burned. I don't know what happened. What happened there? Nobody knows. I painted chairs. I vacuumed all the sawdust up in the and dead newts in the basement. Desiccated newt husks because the kitty kills them. Painted, cut chair seats, four more. I don't know where those are. Four boards I cut and brought upstairs. Don't know where they went. Roasted squash, made black beans, baked a cake, reupholstered a chair. Now I have a dining chair. Focus would be a nice thing. Maybe I should write a character who's as unfocused as me. What would that be like? Sounds super annoying. Because of the plot problem. You lose the plot. Isn't that a thing people say? They lost the plot. They lost the plot. They're not doing the thing to bring about the results that they want. I think reupholstering, is losing the plot. Like, it's not focused on the thing I need to be focusing on. But this really helps. So this is part of the plot. Oh, no. Story and plot. There are many, many stories. And I think the story, of course, the story is the heart of things. The story is what you're actually trying to say, and the plot is what you're using to say it with. That makes sense to me. That is what I was taught. And it really works on an analytical level. Like, if you don't have control of that, you will end up saying things you did not mean to say. You have to have control of the story in order to say what you want to say. Like, you can't just go around saying, you can, and I think people often do, say things they did not intend to say with fiction. I know it's actually kind of a psychoanalytic tool, right? What do you fear the most? What do you want the most? What do you care about the most? What are you most afraid of losing? What do you most want to gain? What worries you the most? What frightens you the most? What gives you the most hope? What do you care about the most? Who do you care about the most? All of that stuff will be in there whether you mean it to or not. And I think that's the story. That's the story. What do you think? How do you think things are going to end? How do you want things to end? How do you think things are going to go? If you let go of the wheel, where are you going to end up? Oh, that's bad. What are you fighting so hard to do that you're forgetting other things, right? Yeah, it's all back to story. And I love to ask students about this. Like, what story do you think you're in? Are you in Cinderella? Are you in Superman? Are you in... And they do tend to get very... What's the word? What's the young thing? Archetypical. They get very archetypal when they start thinking about the stories they're in. And a lot of people do see themselves in hero's journey, and that's totally fine. Oh, and one of my students this week started talking about heroine's journey and how it's different. And that was so interesting to me because they're not wrong. They're absolutely right. The way we write a heroine's journey, and this is what they said, all credit to you, whoever you are. They said there's often well, there's often a relationship or...
Hi, Kitty.
There's often some sort of sex-based thing on top of the rest of the story. And I was like, is there? And then I thought about all my books and like, oh, hell yes, there is. Like, it would be very interesting to write something where that isn't a factor. And it's not, and here we're back to dad books. It doesn't seem to be a factor as much in Hero's Journey, right? Like, why? Why is that? And I don't want to be Neolithic gender-based about this ever. And then suddenly when they said that, I was like, oh no, I think I tend to write economics-based stories. Like, it's people trying to make it work on an economic level. Like, they have to survive. And what I mean by survive is not like they're out on a mountain with a tent and a hatchet. I mean, they have to earn money. They have to earn a living. They need a place to live. I also tend to write family-based. Like, they need a home. They need a home and a family, and they don't have it. And here's how they're going to get it. That is the story I write, how to get a family. And it's sometimes it's found family, sometimes it's made family, like in a relationship thing. But it's almost always a house of some kind. Like, Becca's not going to get a house. Becca lives in a dorm. Becca is, oh no, I just thought of a way to change that story. Okay, I have to go write my book and apparently feed the cat. Yeah, I'm staring at the window, which is now dark, and there's very faint black silhouettes of trees against deep blue sky with my lamp, ceiling lamp superimposed on it. Sorry, I just had to think a lot about that because there's this whole element in 40 Days and 40 Nights with the Becca book that I have never really resolved properly. It's a draft. What is it? 60,000 words. It's a lot I haven't done yet. But there's a problem with her, you'll never guess, her mom. Okay, so Becca's a foster kid. She has not lived with her mother since she was about 8. She's been raised in various families all around the place, some for longer, some for less time. And I've known a bunch of students like this. And if there's ever a fundamental failure in someone's life, it's when their family fails them that way. And other people can step in and love them and take care of them, but it never solves it. It doesn't solve it. And it's such a complex and important psychological situation that it's like, I don't, like, you can't actually overstate it. It's just enormous. It's enormous to be non-familied, you know? And so she's got, her mom is out there though. Her mom is there, but she's had no contact with her since she was 8 because she was removed from a bad situation. But now that she's 18, she is more available. Do you know what I mean? She's out there in the world now. She's not as protected. She's not hidden. She's not like undercover anymore. So her mom gets back into her life and it's not good. It's really bad. But then it's for a good reason. Her mom needs help. The grandmother is very sick. I have to solve it. It's a really big crisis in her family life. And she also discovers this other thing. I have to read this draft again, that she didn't even know about her own history. And it's complex. And she starts making the phone calls that you didn't want to make and finding out the things she didn't want to find out and trying to help her mom. But in doing so, just uncovers all this scary big stuff. It's going to be a good book eventually, but it's really early on right now. It's like I've only half thought it through by writing half of it. A dog is licking me. I should never try to record at animal dinner time because, boy, they are on me. Anyway, I have to think that through. But I don't want her to have that crutch, the financial crutch. I don't want an easy solution. I'm not sure I want a house. I'm thinking about the house. This is the thing. Because the mother is like, we're going to lose the house. And then she's like, wait, when is that house not paid for? I thought that was my grandmother's house. And then it turns out, well, you can remortgage things. But she can't just solve it with money because I don't want her to have the money. Also, I don't want her to give it to the mother. I mean, she got taken away for a very good reason. So it's complicated, isn't it? I guess the question is, what's Becca's story? And what's her plot? And I know her plot, but I'm not sure I know her story. I have never had anybody get past it and like have a relationship with this person who persecuted them. And in her case, you know, like broke her bones and got her taken away. Like this person was bad to her. And I've never, and of course we know why, I've never solved it. Whoop, there's my footstool. I've never solved it, really. I mean, they're always characters. The mother and father people, the parents, there's a word for that, are often, well, I'm going to say always, difficult or impossible. Difficult or impossible. Like, there's a reason their relationship is so bad. And it's not the kid's fault when that happens. If they're a kid, they're a kid. So I've never quite made it so that those parents pull it together and come around. So that story is never the story of, oh, I was estranged from these people who were awful to me, and then we worked it out and everything was all right. It's never that story. It's kind of that story in The Nerve, though. Kind of. She does turn out to be really useful and helpful. Yeah. Part of the reason that's a problem is I'm not giving the parents a story. And they have to have a story if they're going to be major characters in books like this. I'm thinking back to The Seminarian again. There's a story there with the main character and his father who's in prison and this kid. And the father really helps teach him how to be a parent. And it's like a short lesson, but it's a really good lesson. Like, literally, they go to visit him at the prison, and they're not there that long. And they have these conversations that are so good and so intense and so, like, modeling how to do it. And the guy's father, gives them a puzzle that they can solve together. And it changes everything for the two of them, for the guy and the kid. And it's just such a great scene. It's like my favorite scene in anything I've read in a really long time, because it teaches everyone how to solve their problems. And it's such good modeling and parenting and good, humaning. Just like, how often do you ever see anybody? When do you ever see anybody who can just say a thing that literally actually helps like that? When does anybody actually help rather than just like crabbing or being snarky or, you know, like when is that ever a thing? And it's just so emotionally intelligent, this writing. And I guess there's a reason I love the show Bones, and I've seen every single episode a zillion times, because that's in there too, is this kindness and emotional intelligence and not banging your head against the wall, as I often tend to do with that kind of emotional scene. Like, I could never write something like that. This whole time, I wanted to get under the couch because I was like, how is it so complex? Like, you set up all these things and he finds a thing and it's a clue for later. And then we're wondering about this other thing and it's resolved over here. And mysteries alone are hard, but like, this is so complicated and cool because you just get to watch it unfold. It's like those, when people set up a room with all of these stacks of dominoes and you're like, wait, how is it gonna? And then you click the one and it knocks over that one and it does this thing and over here and it's a spiral and the spiral uncurls again the other direction. It's just so good. Ugh. And then I read this terrible literary fiction thing that made me just hate books. So I should go back and read The Seminary again now that I know the plot. Oh, gosh. What a good story. What a good plot. I get excited about structure, and I have to solve the Becca book, don't I? I stopped. I was looking at a list of the episodes of this, and apparently I talked about the Becca book for like one episode and then spent 6 months rewriting Summerlands. Was it 6 months? Something like that. Seven, six, and that's fine. That's as it should be. But now, Becca, your time has come. And that's not even considering the epistolary nature of it, which is how people exist these days. And I interrogated my own niece, who's 18, about ways people communicate these days. And I wrote down everything she said. And then I said, can you order them in order of importance? And she took my phone and she ordered them in order of importance, which is so great. So helpful. I really have to use all that and use it the way that communication works for us, not just like as a thing, like not just like a cute little thing in a book, but like the way you communicate is you, isn't it? It's you. That's you. It's not like this sideline. It's actually you. What are you other than your communication and what you do? What you do is what you are, but also what you say is what you are. What you say matters. And it's just so important. Oh, writing's really good. The animals will not stop tap dancing and licking me and climbing on me and yelling at me. So I think I'm going to go feed them. I have to solve plot and I have to solve story. And I think a great way to do it is to consider genre, because genre does it better. Genre does it better. It does plot infinitely better. And as for story, story's kind of the thing you're trying to say, isn't it? Like, doesn't matter what you do, you're still going to fail in the end. No, shut up. I don't know why people write those miserable books that are about how awful everything is. It doesn't help, does it? I don't know. Does it help? Does it help anybody? Does it help you? Does it help your readers? Who's that for? And why do they like it? Maybe you can tell me. Send me an email at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com and tell me why the stories in literary fiction are so miserable. Why the plots are so non-existent and the stories are so miserable. I don't understand it. Short stories are not that way. And all of the literary short stories I have ever read are not that way. And so I'm not sure why the novel is like that. And it's not cool. Knock it off. I have to think about things, don't I? Which means turning off the dang podcasts and not upholstering and just like focusing. It's hard, isn't it? In a noisy world. Noisy, noisy, noisy. That's another thing in the Becca book. Can you imagine trying to be in a dorm these days? I don't know how they're doing it. It was bad enough when we had like record players, literally record players, cassette players. And now they're just like, you're going to have a dude upstairs who's got some incredible sound system and is playing like, I don't know, those war-based first-person shooter games that are so loud with the explosions and the thundering and like, I would lose my mind. Just thinking about it's making me lose my mind. So I don't know how people do it. And I don't know how she's going to do it. I mean, I suppose they listen to their own stuff loud enough to drown it out. Or they go elsewhere. What else can you do? Putting yourself in the mind of somebody else in a situation that you're not in, I think is very, very good for you. I mean, it's basic empathy, isn't it? Basic empathy. I cannot wait to hear from anybody who was at the book fair who, and I'm thinking of those wonderful young people in that exact age group. I'm thinking of you in specific, and I can remember your faces, which is a miracle for me because that's a real problem of mine. I cannot wait to hear what you thought of the books, and please let me know. I would love to hear about it. Put it on Goodreads, put it wherever, Amazon review, anywhere. I want to hear. I want to know what you thought, because you're the ones. You're the ones actually in this life. All I do is stay home and teach online and pet my animals who are skirmishing around my feet right now as if to say, you must not record anymore. So please tell me what you thought. And I would love to get back to you. And I'm sure you're right, whatever it is you say. Oh, it was so great to meet you guys. Really makes me miss the classroom. Although I think you guys were older. I don't know. Who can tell? All right. I will get back to you next time. Maybe I will come back and talk about A Worn Path, Eudora Welty's story. It's an interesting one. It's really worth studying. It's about, I mean, she's an unreliable narrator, isn't she? But who among us isn't? So I'll be recording next week, obviously, and the week after. I'm off for 2 weeks. It's going to be exciting. I don't know what I'm going to do except for, obviously, books. I didn't really get to go around and see all the other authors at the book fair. I just stayed at my table next to Chris. Hi, Chris. And we had the best time. And I just stayed there and I took one break to run downstairs, use the bathroom and get some cookies, which I shouldn't have been eating. Didn't eat all day. Didn't really drink except coffee. I guess I had a bottle of water that I drank all at once. And it was physically grueling. Anyway, it was physically grueling and just so wonderful. And I did all these other physically grueling, wonderful things. Like I didn't even mention the frickin' revolutionary couch or whatever. It's not. It's from like early 1800s. I went on this crazy journey that one whole day. Went to the gastroenterologist, found out my doctor's been misdiagnosing me for 3 years. Fantastic. Thanks for all the pain. Appreciate it. And then drove out in this incredible storm. Like we had 4 different storm warnings that day. 4 different weather alerts. The National Weather Service was really upset about it. And so I put the trailer on the car and drove out to the back of Beyond, way out, and got this couch, which is from 18 whatever, early 1800s, to reupholster and sell. And I thought it was a replica, and I was just like, oh, well, that's okay. I'm just going to go get it. It's free, and I'm going to fix it up, and I'm going to sell it, and it'll be wonderful. That's what I do. I buy cheap or free furniture, fix it up, reupholster it, and sell it. It's my sideline. It keeps me sane and in a lot of pain. And so I got out there, and the guy was helping me, and he was telling me the story, like, yeah, the house belonged to his wife's parents and their parents and everybody all the way back, and it's way out up the coast, up and down the coast. And we were picking up the thing, and I looked down, and it had these feet. And I'd been doing my research into this particular cabinet maker from back then, and I haven't been able to shut up about him since. I've gotten over it, but for a while there, I could not stop talking about it. And it had the feet. It had the feet that made it an original. And I started shrieking. I was like, it's an original! Like, I got really loud and shrill. And then the woman of the house came down the stairs. She was upstairs on, like, a conference call or a Zoom or something. She came down and said, yes, my family always said it was an original. And I was like, wah! And so we got it out to the trailer. And I had to wrestle it into the house on my own because I'm an idiot. And didn't go ask my landlord, who's next door and would happily help me. And injured myself severely doing it. Of course. When do I not? But now I've got this ridiculous original sofa from this colonial and federal era cabinet maker. And it's uncomfortable. I think they put springs in it somewhere along, like, the late Victorian era. It has such a long history. It's crazy. So it was around for the 1800s and the 1900s and now into the 2000s. So it's just been around forever. It's not that comfortable at all. It has the heaviest cushions in the whole world, to the point where I'm pretty sure when I open them up, there's going to be like Revolutionary War gold or something in them. They're so heavy. They're so heavy I couldn't carry three of them. I had to carry two at once and then go back for the third one. And I had to wrestle it up the steps in this torrential downpour because it was outside wrapped in a tarp. It got to my house perfectly dry, and it got inside perfectly dry, but everything else got wet, and like lakes of water were coming off the tarp because it was just absolutely downpouring while I was doing this. So I was getting it up the four steps by myself and losing my mind because it wouldn't go, and then I had to rotate it and like, okay. And there wasn't enough room. I don't know how I did that. But anyway, now I've got this thing and I've got to reupholster it purple and sell it. Purple's a good color. I like purple. That was only one day, and every day was like that, including book fair day and then family visit day and then going everywhere around town with my sister day. And then, like, it just wouldn't quit, and I was destroyed for a week, and I shouldn't have been because, come on, that's not that much effort. Seriously, like, moving one piece of furniture, however difficult, should not wreck you for a week. But it wasn't that. It was like the hours of driving and crossing the Penobscot Narrows Bridge with my trailer in like terrifying high winds and all this. And I was like, well, this is it. This is the day I get blown off the bridge. But I didn't. Everybody survived. You and me, the cat and the dog, and Duncan, my new sofa, my new very old sofa with the golden cushions. It's probably just like old horsehair or something in there. Ew, they reupholstered it and they left the old stuff in there, I think, because they're so heavy. It'll be so much more comfortable once I redo it. Not soon. Also, wasn't I just saying I needed to quit it? I need to do physical tasks or I lose my mind, though. And they are at least physical. Reupholstering. I need to have a couch roundup, reupholstered furniture roundup of the year. And look at all the things I've done because they are legion, as my arms can attest. And a book roundup. Oh, I mean, I did publish a book this year. Very small, and wrote it a long time ago. But I did write a book this year. And that's awesome. It makes me happy. All right. I will talk to you next week. And maybe we'll get to A Worn Path. Maybe we'll talk about something else, depending on what I read. And meanwhile, have a great holiday. Happy solstice. Or happy inexplicable phenomenon, as someone said to the flat earth people. Happy inexplicable phenomenon. How do they explain the days getting shorter and longer? How do they explain that? I'm not going to look into it because maybe I will for a character. I don't know. It might be fun. In the seminary, and our main character has a flat earth guy living downstairs, but he's a lovely character. So I don't, like, it's never a joke or anything. It's just he calls him the flat earth guy. What goes into that thinking? I mean, I know what it is. Conspiracy theories always are underlain by wanting to know better, wanting to be the one who knows better, who can see behind the curtain and understand things as they really are, which is why The Matrix sent everybody over the edge. But I mean, it came from there as well as going to there. All right. I hope you're reading great things. Send me an email. Let me know. I hope you're watching great things. I hope you're writing great things. Please, you know, send an email. Let me know. And if you need any books, just go to my site. It's under merch. And also I made it so under books, the books now have links. You can just go to the books. Some of them are not out yet, like The Nerve, but and Summerlands. Summerlands I pushed to the end of January, which is even that is ludicrous. All right. I will talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye. Sacred Cheese of Life.